The men kept a sharp eye out as they rode through the giant redwoods. Even though none of them had actually ever seen the Terror, they had heard plenty about it. Everybody had, in this neck of the woods. The Terror was the talk of every saloon and whorehouse and logging camp. After what had happened today, that would be even more true. The news of the Terror's latest massacre would spread like a wildfire. That was exactly what their boss wanted. One of the men was named Radburn, a chunky man with a squarish red face that got even redder when he was angry. The one called Jack Grimshaw was ramrodding this gang of killers. He was a gaunt-faced, middle-aged hombre with iron-gray hair under a black Stetson. Another gunman was a lunger everybody called Hooley.
Hey, Grimshaw, when do we get our money?
You anxious to get paid, Radburn?
Damn right I am. You know, doing this don't sit well with me.
Well, I thought you'd kill men before, Radburn. Didn't realize you was a blushing little flower.
I've killed my share, and you know it, Hooley. That don't trouble me. I'm talking about what happens afterward.
Without that, folks wouldn't think the Terror was to blame. You know as well as I do why it was necessary.
Because the boss paid us to do it that way.
That's right. If that bothers you too much, Radburn, I don't reckon you have to take his money.
I never said anything about not taking the money.
I didn't think so.
They rode on. 15 hard-faced men, all of them with plenty of blood on their hands even before today. But there was more blood staining them now. A lot more, Grimshaw reflected. He had seen a lot of ugly things in his life. But right offhand, he couldn't think of anything uglier than taking axes and chopping a bunch of dead men into pieces. Would it fool people when they found the bodies? Grimshaw thought it would, since everybody in these parts was so worked up to start with about the monster in the woods. But the important thing, as far as his boss was concerned, was that more damage had been done to Rutherford Chamberlain's logging operation. Whatever had been killing men out here in the woods was doing Grimshaw's employer, Emmett Bosworth, a favor. But Bosworth wasn't a patient man. He had decided to push things along a little faster, and for that reason, he had recruited Grimshaw and the other gunmen. Grimshaw, Radburn, Hooley, and the others had all been involved in range wars in the past. A timber war was really no different. Rutherford Chamberlain had the trees, and Emmett Bosworth wanted them. Simple as that. Grimshaw had assumed at first that he and his fellow gunmen would be carrying out the same sort of campaign they had waged on behalf of various cattle barons, ambushing Chamberlain's men, sabotaging his equipment, generally making life hell for anybody who worked for Chamberlain. Bosworth had come up with another idea, though. He wanted to take advantage of the fear that was spreading through the forest. The so-called Terror already had men plenty spooked. If the Terror seemed to be going on an even worse killing spree, Chamberlain's men might finally start refusing to venture into the woods and do their work. A man couldn't cut logs without loggers. That was Bosworth's idea, and it was a good one as far as Grimshaw was concerned. When Chamberlain had to give up his lease on this prime area of timber, Bosworth would move in, and then Grimshaw and the other men would have a new job. They would go into the woods, hunt down the Terror, whatever it was, and kill it.
Son of a bitch!
What is it, Nichols?
Damn horse is gone lame. I'm gonna have to get off and walk for a spell, see if he can shake it off. Unless I can ride double with one of you fellas.
I don't think so.
Well, you're gonna get ahead of me, though.
Afraid of the Terror, Nichols?
Well, wouldn't you be?
I ain't afraid of anything. No reason to be.
The rest of them knew what Hooley meant. He coughed up blood a dozen times a day. He wouldn't last another 6 months, no matter what. Probably not another three. When a man spent all his waking hours staring down that particular barrel, he really didn't have any reason to be scared of anything else.
Well, then why don't you stay with me, so I won't have to ride on into Eureka by myself?
You think I won't?
Well, I'm hoping you will. I don't much cotton to the idea of being out here in the woods by myself.
Sure. Why the hell not? The rest of you fellas go on. Me and Nichols will be there later. You better not spend our part of the money on hooch and whores before we get there, though, Grimshaw.
Don't worry, you'll get your dinero. Come on, boys.
Nichols dismounted as the others rode on, with the exception of Hooley, who sat there with his hands crossed and resting on the saddle horn. While Hooley waited, Nichols examined the horse's front legs and hooves.
I was hoping maybe he just picked up a rock or something in his shoe. Looks like he's gone lame, though. It's gonna be a long walk back to town.
Might as well get started. I just as soon not stay out here any longer than we have to.
Nichols picked up his horse's reins and started leading the animal as Hooley turned his mount to follow the others.
Oh, I thought you wasn't scared.
I ain't. I just don't care much for the woods, that's all. I'd rather be in town where I can get a drink and rest my eyes on a nice-looking woman if I want to.
The two men made their way through the towering trees, moving slowly because of Nichols' horse. They had gone maybe half a mile when both animals began to act a little strange. Hooley's horse lifted its head and pricked up its ears, then gave a violent shake of its head. Nichols' mount started pulling back on the reins as if it didn't want to go forward anymore.
What's got into these damn jugheads?
They act like they smell something they don't like. Can't say as I smell anything, though.
My horse's nose is more sensitive than yours. I don't like this, Hooley.
Don't go scaring yourself. You know how horses can get all spooky for no good reason. One of them starts to act up, then the other one has to do the same thing. There's nothing to worry about.
You don't know that. There's so many damn trees, you can't see 50 yards. You don't know what's out there.
Neither do you.
Come on, horse, damn it. You want the terror to get you?
We don't know there's any such thing as a terror.
Oh, yeah? Well, something killed all those other men. We didn't take cards in the game until today, remember?
Probably a bear, or maybe a mountain lion.
I don't think they have mountain lions around here. Or bears big enough to...
Nichols' horse suddenly reared up on its hind legs, jerking the reins out of his hands, as it pawed at the air with its forehooves. From the corner of his eye, Hooley caught sight of something moving in the trees to his left. Something big and fast.
Son of a bitch!
Hooley jerked his horse around. His gun seemed to leap into his hand. He might be sick, but his illness hadn't affected his speed with a Colt. His head snapped from side to side as he looked for the thing, whatever it was. He wanted something to shoot at. Hooley had never run into anything he couldn't kill, except for the thing that was eating him up from the inside out.
Calm down, horse, damn it! Oh, damn it!
Nichols tried to grab the horse's reins and bring the animal back under control. Despite being lame, fear gave the horse some unexpected agility. It twisted away from Nichols and bolted, running around one of the giant redwoods that was close to 20 feet in diameter. The horse didn't come out from the other side.
He got my horse! Son of a bitch! My rifle's still on the saddle! Pull me up behind you! Let's get the hell out of here!
Hooley was having trouble keeping his own mount under some semblance of control. The horse danced back and forth skittishly as Nichols clawed at Hooley's leg and tried to climb up behind him.
Get off!
Hooley slashed at Nichols with the six-gun, raking the barrel across the other man's face. Nichols fell back as blood flew from the gash on his forehead, opened up by the gun sight.
Oh, Hooley! Oh, Hooley, you gotta help me!
I'm not riding double. That damn thing's too fast.
Hooley hauled his horse's head around and jammed his boot heels into the animal's flanks. The horse broke into a frantic run.
Hooley! Hooley, don't leave me out here! Don't let it!
Hooley leaned forward in the saddle and didn't look back as he sent his horse racing around and between the giant tree trunks. He didn't want to see what was happening back there. All he wanted was to get out of here before whatever that thing was caught him too. Funny, he thought as his heart pounded heavily in his chest. Maybe the time he had left to him, however long it might be, was still precious to him after all. Frank heard the yelling in the distance. In this thick forest, it was hard to judge how far away such sounds were. Couldn't be too far, he told himself, because the thick vegetation tended to muffle noises and keep them from carrying as well.
Stay with me, Wolf.
Frank didn't know what they were heading toward, but it couldn't be anything good. There were no shots. Frank didn't know what that meant. He had a feeling it wasn't a good sign. It was like the man who had gotten into trouble hadn't even had time to pull his gun, only to scream in fear and pain. Wolf had been tracking the bushwhackers who had attacked that logging camp, and Frank had been following. He estimated their numbers at more than a dozen, so he didn't plan on jumping them. He had more in mind following them, finding out who they were, and more importantly, who they worked for. He thought he had a pretty good idea, but he needed confirmation of that. Wolf dashed ahead, as if he had caught a familiar scent again, and Frank pushed Goldie hard to keep up. A minute later, Wolf stopped short, planting his feet and stiffening his legs. Frank reined to a halt behind him and pulled the Winchester from its sheath. Up ahead, lying next to the base of a tree, was a horse. The animal lay still. Blood still welled from a gaping wound in its neck.
Wolf, back!
The big cur obeyed, backing up until he was next to Frank and Goldie. Frank sent the horse forward at a slow walk. he circled to the left, around the tree and the body of the horse. The horse wore a saddle, so Frank had a feeling that its former rider was around here somewhere. A moment later, he saw he was right. A man lay on the ground on the far side of the tree, face down. He was as motionless as the horse. The back of his shirt was shredded and soaked with blood. The man had lost so much blood, it had formed a pool around him on the ground. Frank knew he couldn't still be alive. So for the next couple of minutes, instead of dismounting, Frank sat there, looking and listening intently, taking in everything that was going on in the woods around him. Finally satisfied that whatever had done this was no longer nearby, Frank swung down from the saddle and hunkered on his heels next to the body. He held the rifle in one hand, took hold of the dead man's shoulder with the other, and rolled the corpse onto its back. The man's face was smeared with blood, but not a lot of it. The blood looked like it had come from a gash in the man's forehead. Other than that, his face was unmarked. It was a horrifying sight anyway, because it was frozen and twisted in lines of such fear that the man must have died feeling sheer terror all the way down to his soul. Frank's jaw tightened as he studied the man's face. He tried to put aside for the moment the fear and the blood and concentrate on what the man must have looked like in life. After a moment, he came to the conclusion that he had never seen the dead man before. He had seen the type plenty of times, though. The narrow, unshaven face, the weak mouth and chin, the small, deep-set eyes. This man had been a hired killer. Frank was sure of it. And it didn't take much to figure out from there that he'd been a member of the gang of gunwolves that had massacred the men back there at Chamberlain's logging camp and then mutilated their bodies. He wondered if Marshal Gene Price would recognize the gunman. Still hunkered beside the body, he began looking around for some broken branches he could use to fashion a travois using one of his blankets. He wasn't going to load the gruesome corpse onto Goldie's back, but would drag it back to Eureka on a makeshift sled instead. The blanket he used would be ruined, but Frank could afford to buy another. Spotting some branches that might work, he straightened to his feet. And just as he did, a rifle cracked and a bullet whizzed past his ear. Instantly, more shots rang out, and Frank threw himself into a dive that carried him behind the tree.
Wolf, cover!
He glanced over and saw that Wolf had darted behind another tree. It was smaller than the one where Frank had taken shelter, but big enough to shield the shaggy, wolf-like creature from any harm. And Goldie, he was glad to see, had dashed off out of sight among the trees. Frank was surprised that neither Wolf nor Goldie had scented the bushwhackers creeping up on them. He supposed that the smell of freshly spilled blood and the stench of whatever had done this might have masked any other scents, at least enough to keep the animals from noticing anything else unusual. As Frank lay there on the carpet of needles, he wondered who was shooting at him. Of course, it was possible the riflemen were the same ones who had attacked the logging camp. But they had been headed the other direction, toward Eureka. They might have gotten behind him, but Frank considered it unlikely. The only other explanation, though, was that there were two gangs of killers out here, as well as something that could claw a man to death or rip him apart with apparently equal ease. Frank cradled the Winchester's smooth stock against his cheek and crawled to one side so that he could risk a glance around the trunk.
These woods are getting a mite crowded.
The sound of the shots told him this was indeed a different group, or at least a smaller one. He estimated that 5 or 6 men had opened fire on him. The larger gang could have split up, but again, he couldn't see any reason why they would have done that, and why some of them would have circled around to get behind him. Checking their back trail, maybe? He couldn't rule it out. The bushwhackers stopped firing. They must have realized that they could throw lead at that tree all day without doing any real damage. Frank looked over at Wolf. The big cur was trained to respond to hand signals, too, as well as Frank's voice. Frank made one of those signals now, a gesture that meant hunt. Staying on his belly, Wolf crawled out from behind the tree where he had taken cover. Either the bushwhackers didn't see him, or they didn't care that he was on the move. If it was the latter, they might have reason to regret their carelessness in a few minutes, Frank thought. Wolf disappeared into the brush. Frank waited. He knew how to be patient. The ability to remain still and silent had saved his life on numerous occasions. Frank knew from the sounds he heard that at least some of the bushwhackers were on the move. Wolf wouldn't make that much racket while he was hunting, not on his worst day. The sounds continued, moving to Frank's left now. He twisted in that direction and snugged the Winchester's butt against his shoulder. His eyes narrowed as he searched for any sign of movement that would give him a target. Some of the brush swayed a little, and then he caught a glimpse of a rifle barrel. Frank opened fire, cranking off 3 rounds as fast as he could work the rifle's lever. The bullets lashed through the brush. He obviously hit someone, and then someone returned the fire. They hurried their shots, though, and the slugs just hit the tree several feet above Frank's head as he crawled backward out of the line of fire.
of a bitch!
Let's get the hell out of here!
Frank stood up and pressed his back against the tree trunk. When he heard hoofbeats, he stepped out and triggered several more rounds in that direction. He couldn't see the fleeing bushwhackers, so he didn't have any real hope of hitting them, but at least he could hurry them on their way. No shots came back toward him, so he was convinced that whoever the ambushers were, they had given up on killing him, at least for the moment.
Wolf!
A minute later, the big cur came bounding out of the brush. The flecks of blood on his muzzle testified that he had sunk his teeth into at least one of the gunmen. Frank roughed up the fur on his head.
Good boy.
He signaled for Goldie, who promptly answered the summons just as Wolf had. Frank took down his bedroll, removed one of the blankets from it, and used the blanket and those broken branches he had decided on earlier to make a travois. Once he had the corpse loaded onto it, he replaced the rest of the bedroll, taking care that the bone he found in the primitive cabin was still wrapped up securely. The morning's developments meant that he needed to return to Eureka now, instead of continuing his search for the Terror. For one thing, it was clear now that more danger lurked in the woods than just the supposed monster. Frank wanted to get a lead on the man whose body he had found, if possible. He planned to keep his theories about Emmett Bosworth to himself for the time being, though. He would just tell the marshal that he had found the dead man in the woods and wouldn't say anything about the massacre at the logging camp. Somebody else would come across that soon enough, Frank figured. More of Chamberlain's men were bound to show up there and make the grisly discovery. Dragging the travois with its gruesome burden behind his horse, Frank rode toward Eureka. He kept the Winchester across the saddle in front of him, just in case he ran into any more trouble, human or otherwise. Treadwell's face was gray with pain as he hunched forward in his saddle.
Bad enough that bastard Morgan kicked me in the balls last night. Now he had to go shoot me too.
You'll live. Morgan's bullet just knocked a chunk of meat out of your arm. At least you can sit in your saddle without hurting too bad. That wolf dog of Morgan's practically tore poor Sutherland's ass off.
It ain't funny. That critter was vicious.
Who do you think that other hombre was? One Morgan found?
I don't know. I didn't get a good look at him. All I know is that he was dead. Nobody could lose that much blood and still be alive.
The Terror got him. That must be what happened.
We'll get the Terror. But we need to get Morgan first.
Don't you reckon old man Chamberlain would pay us the bounty anyway if we showed up at his house with the thing's head?
I don't know. He might. He might say it didn't count anymore. You fellas who work for him know him better than I do. Is he a tight-fisted old son of a bitch?
He pays fair wages. He don't go out of his way to give anybody anything extra, though.
There you go. Chances are he'd use any excuse not to have to pay the bounty. So, it'll be better if we kill Morgan first, then the monster.
Easier said than done. We didn't do a very good job of it today.
This was just our first try. We'll stick like burrs to Morgan, and the next time, we'll fill his hide with lead.
Hooley caught up with the rest of Bosworth's hired gunmen before they reached Eureka. When Jack Grimshaw heard the horse coming up fast behind them, he reined in and motioned for the others to do likewise. Hooley galloped up and joined them, bringing his mount to a sliding stop on the logging road they were following now. Grimshaw saw the wild look in Hooley's pale, watery eyes and guessed that something had happened.
Where's Nichols?
I don't know. I had to leave him back there.
You were supposed to stay with him.
Yeah, well, that was before something spooked his horse and made it run away. Damn horse ran right into whatever it was, scared it, though. I never heard an animal scream like that in my life.
So you ran off and left Nichols there on foot with that thing in the woods?
He'd already had him. What was I supposed to do? Stay there and get torn up too?
Did you see the thing?
Not really. Just caught a glimpse of it through the trees. It was mighty big and fast. Shaggy, too, like a critter. But it's a critter the likes of which I ain't never seen around here before. Or anywhere else, either.
Maybe so. But I don't like the fact that you just left him there. We're supposed to all be working together.
Easy for you to say. You weren't there.
Hooley's tense, angry attitude as he spoke, and the way he moved his hand just slightly toward the butt of his gun, made Grimshaw stiffen in the saddle. He was ready to slap leather too, if Hooley wanted to push the matter.
Damn it, we've already lost one man today. We don't need the two of you gunning for each other too.
Grimshaw kept his cold, level stare locked on Hooley for a couple of seconds longer, then nodded.
Radburn's right. What's done is done. We let it go.
Just don't be calling me a coward.
I never said that. I can't help what you think of yourself, though.
Come on. Let's get on to town and collect our pay.
Now you're talking. Maybe the boss will have another job for us, too.
I wouldn't count on anything else right away. Bosworth will want to let what happened today soak in on everybody for a while.
The atmosphere among the hired killers eased as they approached the settlement. Most of them were thinking now of the money they had coming to them and how they would spend it. The saloons and whorehouses in Eureka would do a booming business tonight. While they were still outside of town, Grimshaw reined in.
We'll split up here. The rest of you drift into the Bull of the Woods, one or two at a time, as usual. I'll see the boss and meet you there in a little while.
Don't lose any of that money along the way.
I know you fellas. I'm not enough of a damn fool to try something like that.
Damn right. We'd hunt you down and take it out of your hide.
That's enough. Let's go get a drink. Killing is thirsty work.
Grimshaw left the others at the saloon and headed on up the street toward the Eureka House. It was midday, and the town was busy, the streets full of pedestrians and buggies and wagons, and a few men like Grimshaw on horseback. He drew up in front of the hotel and dismounted. After tying his horse at the hitch rail, Grimshaw went inside, striding through the lobby without stopping at the desk. He knew where he was going. His destination was a suite of rooms on the front of the hotel, overlooking the street. Grimshaw raised his hand to knock, but someone inside jerked the door open before he could rap on the panel. Emmett Bosworth stood there in his shirt sleeves, his collar undone. Bosworth was tall and broad-shouldered, and his frame still retained some of the muscular power that swinging an axe as a young man had given him. He must have been looking out the window and seen Grimshaw approaching the hotel. He glared at the gunman.
Is it done?
Grimshaw nodded and opened his mouth to speak, but Bosworth held up a hand and stopped him. The timber magnate opened the door a little wider and inclined his head toward the divan where an attractive, nearly nude woman lay curled up with her eyes closed and a satisfied smile on her face.
Give me a few minutes.
Grimshaw nodded and stepped back as Bosworth closed the door. He understood now why Bosworth hadn't wanted him to say anything. He didn't want the woman to overhear any details of the job that might come back later and implicate him in mass murder. Grimshaw strolled down to the end of the corridor and waited, looking out a window at the alley that ran alongside the hotel. He didn't see anything more interesting than a big yellow cat rummaging through some garbage.
Take care, dear. Till next time.
Grimshaw didn't turn around. She hadn't gotten a look at his face, and he figured Bosworth would want to keep it that way. A moment later, he heard Bosworth approaching him and turned. Bosworth gestured curtly.
Come on.
Bosworth had fastened his collar, put on a tie and his coat. He looked like the successful businessman he was. As he led Grimshaw into the sitting room of the suite, he went on.
Can I get you a drink?
You damn sure can.
Bosworth picked up a cut crystal decanter of bourbon from a fancy sideboard and splashed the fiery liquor into a couple of glasses. He handed one to Grimshaw.
To the success of your mission.
Yeah.
Some men were content to guzzle any sort of rot gut or panther piss. Grimshaw liked the finer stuff in life, including liquor, which was why he had attached himself to Emmett Bosworth a year earlier, when the timberman had first approached him about ramrodding a crew of troubleshooters, as Bosworth called them, while he expanded his operation into the area of Northern California now controlled by Rutherford Chamberlain. Grimshaw had known right away what Bosworth was getting at. Anytime one strong man tried to take something away from another strong man, there was bound to be trouble. In most cases, gun trouble. Grimshaw had been in that position many times in the past and knew what went with the job. He'd helped Bosworth recruit other men, some of them known personally to Grimshaw, like Radburn. Others, like Hooley, he had only heard of from mutual acquaintances. Now the group was at full strength, and Bosworth was ready to make his move. The attack on Chamberlain's camp this morning was just the opening salvo.
You did it like we discussed.
Grimshaw nodded as he helped himself to another drink, feeling confident enough in his relationship with Bosworth to do so.
Yeah, it went just like you wanted it to. Better get ready for a real uproar. I expect the news will be all over town before the day's over.
I hope it is. Once the rest of Chamberlain's men hear about it, they'll be quitting him in droves.
Maybe. The Terror's been around for a while, though. Not many of them have quit so far.
And the Terror's never gone on a rampage like this before. And in a few days, the monster will strike again. I was thinking that perhaps next time, the Terror will burn down Chamberlain's sawmill.
Are you sure that's a good idea? That seems like something might too intelligent for that varmint to do.
You make it look like an accident. The fire will start while the Terror is ripping apart some of Chamberlain's men.
Might work. Let me mull it over some more.
Take your time. Just not too much time. We don't want Chamberlain's men to start believing they're safe again.
Grimshaw downed the rest of his second drink and set the empty glass on the sideboard.
The fellas will want their money.
Of course. Wait here.
Bosworth left the room, going through a door into the adjacent bedroom. He closed the door behind him. Clearly, he didn't want Grimshaw to see where his cash was hidden. Bosworth came back with a handful of greenbacks.
$4,000, as we agreed. Now, I won't ask you how you plan to split it with the others.
And I won't tell you. It was a gal.
Never you mind about who the lady was. Suffice it to say, she has a husband who wouldn't be happy if he knew what had happened here this morning.
Sure, boss. Sorry I brought it up. I'll go give the boys their share. Much obliged.
Just keep doing your job. There'll be a lot more where that came from.
When Grimshaw reached the hotel porch, he paused and looked both ways along the street. A man on horseback caught his attention. The hombre was riding a big gold-colored horse and had a shaggy dog that looked more like a wolf padding along beside him. The man had rigged a crude travois, and he was dragging it along behind the horse with something loaded on it. Grimshaw stiffened as he looked closer at the thing on the travois. Then he nodded slowly, as if realizing that what he was looking at was inevitable. He had known this man was in Eureka. He had heard the talk, and sooner or later, they were bound to run into each other. Grimshaw gave his hat brim a tug, stepped down off the porch, and walked out in the street to intercept the man. As the fella reined in, Grimshaw lifted his left hand in greeting and smiled.
Howdy, Frank. Long time no see.
Frank didn't recognize the man who had hailed him right away, although he knew he should remember the hombre. The stranger was almost as old as Frank, and while Frank couldn't put a name with the face right offhand, he recognized the casual stance, the alertness in the eyes, the way the man's right hand never strayed far from the butt of his gun. He was ready to hook and draw in case this fella had an old grudge against him that needed settling.
Remember that time we decided to go fishing in the Brazos River while it was flooding? Like to wash us both away.
Jack? Jack Grimshaw?
That's right. How are you, Frank?
I'm all right. A little stiffer than I used to be when I get up in the morning.
Ain't we all? Somebody run into some trouble?
Yeah, bad trouble. You wouldn't happen to know him, would you?
Let me take a look.
Grimshaw moved closer to the corpse and studied its face. Frank swung down from the saddle and stood beside him, holding Goldie's reins.
What do you think?
Sorry, don't think I've ever seen him before. I don't see any wounds either. What'd he die of? Looks like it was pretty bad, judging by the expression on his face.
You don't see any wounds because he's lying on his back. The Terror got him. Clawed him wide open.
The Terror? You mean that monster folks say is out in the woods? You really believe in a thing like that, Frank?
I wasn't sure at first, but I've seen its handiwork now, several times. It's real, all right. I just don't know exactly what it is.
Well, whatever got him, I'm sorry this hombre had to die the way he did. Looks like it was a bad way to go.
Yeah.
Where are you taking him? The Undertaker's parlor?
I thought I'd stop at the Marshal's office first. See if maybe he recognizes the gent.
In the distance, Price was walking down the street towards Frank.
I don't think you'll have to go all the way to the Marshal's office. Judging by the badge on the vest of that hombre down the street, the law is coming to you. I'll be moseying on, Frank. Mighty good to see you again. Maybe we can get together later and have a drink, catch up on old times.
Still don't care much for badge toters, eh?
They make me antsy, even when I ain't done nothing.
I'll be seeing ya.
As Grimshaw strolled away, and Marshal Price continued hurrying toward Frank. The drifter's thoughts went back to the last time he had seen Jack Grimshaw.
They'll be coming soon. You ready, Frank?
Ready as I'll ever be.
Frank was next to the window on the other side of the ramshackle old cabin's only door. Whenever he risked a glance out that window, he could see a magnificent vista of Wyoming mountains spread out before him. Unfortunately, Hidden out there in the trees and the brush were nearly a dozen hardened gunmen who wanted to kill Frank and Jack Grimshaw because Frank and Grimshaw rode for one side in the deadly war that had spread across this part of the territory, and they rode for the other. It was as simple as that. A fella took money from one man, and he became mortal enemies with the hombres who took money from another man. That was crazy, Frank had been known to think, but it was the way of the West, and had been ever since the great cattle barons had begun clashing over the rich rangeland. Of course, for some men, things were a little more complicated. Frank himself had never sold his gun strictly for cash, despite the reputation that had attached itself to him over the years. The only causes he fought for were the ones he believed in. In this case, he had allied himself with a rancher named Maynard Pollinger, an Englishman who had come to this country to make a new life for himself because he'd had the misfortune to be born the second son in an aristocratic British family. Pollinger wasn't looking for trouble, but his MP spread had grown to be successful enough that it attracted the attention of Pete Dwyer, the boss of the Diamond D. Dwyer regarded Pollinger as a threat, and so he had started trying to run him out of the territory, sending hired guns to ambush Pollinger's cowboys, poison his water holes, and stampede his stock. Pollinger had had no choice but to fight back using the same methods. Jack Grimshaw was one of the men he had hired. Frank was another. They had been riding Pollinger's range today when they had been ambushed by a group of Dwyer's gun wolves. Forced to flee, they had taken shelter in this old line shack. But even as they forted up inside the shack, both men had known that it would be only a matter of time before their enemies rushed them. The numbers were on the side of Dwyer's men. They would lose a few, without any doubt. But in the end, they would overrun the cabin and kill Frank and Grimshaw. As Frank waited beside the window, a 6-gun in each hand, ready to sell his life as dearly as possible, he suddenly heard a thump on the roof overhead. So did Grimshaw, who looked up.
Damn it!
A couple of seconds later, both of them smelled smoke. That didn't come as a surprise to either Frank or Grimshaw. Dwyer's men had decided they didn't want to lose anybody. One of them had gotten behind the line shack and tossed a torch onto the roof. They were going to smoke out their quarry. Grimshaw's lips drew back from his teeth in a grimace as he looked over at Frank.
We go out shooting?
Only way to go.
You know, you might have a better chance of getting away if I drew their fire first.
We go together, or not at all.
The hell with that!
Before Frank could even move, his companion had bounded out the door and was running toward the trees. The irons in Grimshaw's hands blazed as they threw out a storm of lead.
Blast it!
Frank darted through the door as well. He saw men to either side of the cabin and fired in both directions at once. He saw several of Dwyer's killers go down. Up ahead, Jack Grimshaw stumbled, twisted, went down. Crimson flowers bloomed on Grimshaw's shirt. Frank ran to him, stood over him, and kept firing, expecting to feel lead smashing into him too at any second. Then, the sudden pounding of hoofbeats and a fresh rattle of gunfire changed things. A group of riders led by Maynard Pollinger swept down out of the hills toward the burning line shack, and that tipped the balance. The newcomers' bullets riddled Dwyer's men, except for a couple who fled frantically. Safe again, and miraculously unhit, Frank dropped to a knee beside Grimshaw and rolled the man onto his back.
Jack, damn it. If you just waited a minute, help was on the way.
Well, we didn't know that, did we?
If you hadn't been trying to give me a better chance...
Well, I always figured to go out shooting anyway.
Maynard Pollinger rode up and quickly dismounted.
How badly is he hit, Frank?
Shot through the body 3 or 4 times, looks like.
We'll take him back to the ranch. I'll send a man right now to fetch the doctor from town. We'll do everything we can to save his life. I give you my word on that.
Frank looked down at Grimshaw's gaunt gray face and figured it was too late for that. He'd been wrong, though. Maynard Pollinger was true to his word. He got the best medical attention possible for Grimshaw, nursed the gunman through the critical first few days, then took him to the doctor's house in Laramie as soon as Grimshaw was strong enough to stand the trip. Frank heard later that Grimshaw had been laid up for 8 months, but eventually he made a full recovery. Frank had seen the proof of that with his own eyes here in Eureka. The range war between the MP and the Diamond D had ended in rather prosaic fashion only a couple of weeks after the fight at the line shack. A horse had kicked Pete Dwyer in the head, and after a couple of days of lingering and unconsciousness, the cattle baron had died. His grieving widow didn't have the stomach to continue the war. In fact, she had sold the ranch and left Wyoming territory, and after that, things had become downright peaceful in the region. All the hired gunmen drifted on, including Frank, once he had satisfied himself that Grimshaw was getting the best care possible. The history between Frank Morgan and Jack Grimshaw went back a lot further than that range war in Wyoming, though. They had known each other as boys growing up near Weatherford, Texas, and had spent a considerable amount of time fishing, as Grimshaw had mentioned. They had ridden hell for leather across the wooded hills of the Cross Timbers as wild young cowboys. Frank had gone on the drift after the war when he began to get a reputation for being fast on the draw. As far as he knew at the time, Grimshaw had remained behind to continue working as a cowhand. A few years later, though, he had run into his friend in Santa Fe and discovered that Grimshaw had abandoned ranch life too and was now walking the thin line that divided the law-abiding from the outlaws. He wasn't as slick with a gun as Frank, but he was fast enough to stay alive. As fellow members of the gunfighting fraternity, they had run into each other several times over the years. The West, for all its untamed vastness, was a small place in many ways. The two of them had fought on the same side more than once. Grimshaw had saved Frank's life in a fight in Wichita, and Frank had returned the favor during a dust-up at Yankton. Now, Frank was pleased to see Grimshaw again, pleased that Grimshaw seemed to be doing all right. Those memories flashed through Frank's mind in a second as he stood there in Eureka's main street. He put the thoughts of his old friends out of his mind, though, because now Marshal Gene Price was standing in front of him, an angry look on his face.
What the hell's all this?
I was hoping you could tell me, Marshal. I found this man out in the woods. Looks like the terror got him.
The terror, huh?
His back is clawed up pretty bad. I reckon he died from losing so much blood. Have you ever seen him before?
Yeah, maybe. I think I've seen him around town. I don't know his name, though.
Or what he was doing here?
Doing the same thing as every other damn fool in these parts, I reckon. Hunting that damn monster. Maybe I should say that's what they were doing until you came along, Morgan. You sort of taken over that job, haven't you?
I just figured it'd be a good idea if the woods weren't full of men shooting anything that moves.
Yeah. And if you earn yourself $10,000 in the process, then so much the better, huh?
I'm gonna take the body on down to the undertaking parlor and spread the word that folks should go by there and see if they can identify it. Maybe somebody will claim the body.
I wouldn't count on it. Hard cases like that usually don't have many friends.
Frank took up Goldie's reins and began leading the horse along the street. Price walked alongside him, and they went toward the undertaker's place.
I don't see why it matters to you who he is.
Just curious, I guess. I don't think there's any connection between the terror's victims. They're just hombres who were unlucky to run into the thing. But, you never know. I might find out something that would help me track it down.
You know, seems to me that you've been mighty close to that thing several times now. And it hadn't come after you. Maybe there's some connection between you and it.
You're barking up the wrong redwood, Marshal. I'd never even heard of the terror until yesterday. I don't know what it is. I just want to put a stop to the killing.
Old gunfighter wanting to put a stop to the killing. Uh-huh. If I don't beat all.
They reached the undertaking parlor and found the proprietor, a fat man with a round, unaccountably jolly face, waiting for them.
Take the deceased around back. I heard about you bringing a body into town, Mr. Morgan, so I have a couple of my assistants waiting back there to take charge of the remains.
Before I do that, you recognize this hombre?
Can't say as I do, but then I don't pay much attention to what folks look like until I see them under these circumstances. When they're never at their best.
Frank turned the dead man over to the undertaker's assistants, and he and Marshal Price left the place.
What are you going to do now, Morgan?
I thought I'd get some lunch. Then I plan to go out and try to pick up the terror's trail again.
How do you figure on killing a thing that can do that?
Reckon I'll figure that out when the time comes.
Grimshaw looked around as he went into the Bull of the Woods saloon. His men were scattered around the establishment's big main room, drinking in groups of two or three, but not clustered together, so it was obvious that they knew each other. That was the way Emmett Bosworth wanted it. The timber magnate didn't want anyone in Eureka suspecting that he had assembled a gang of hired killers. As Grimshaw went to the bar, he caught the eye of the man on the other side of the hardwood. He gave the bartender a tiny nod.
Give me a beer, Harry.
The drink juggler drew the beer, wiped the bar in front of Grimshaw with his rag, and then set down the foaming mug. When Grimshaw picked up the mug, his other hand moved smoothly to rest on the spot where the beer had been. That move with the rag had allowed Harry the bartender to slip a key under the mug, and now Grimshaw's hand rested on it without anyone being the wiser. When he moved his hand, the key went with it. The key unlocked a door that opened from the alley behind the Bull of the Woods into the saloon's back room. There was nothing in that room except a table and some chairs. From time to time, private poker games took place there. Months ago, Grimshaw had slipped Harry a tidy little sum to ensure that he and the other men working for Bosworth would have a place to meet where no one could observe them together. Grimshaw drank about half the beer, then left the rest and walked out of the saloon after tossing a coin on the bar to pay for the drink. The others knew what to do. After making sure that no one on the street was paying any attention to him, Grimshaw stepped into the narrow passage beside the building and made his way to the alley and back. He unlocked the door, stepped into the private room. It had one window, but the shade was tightly drawn. Within minutes, the first of the other men showed up, seeking entrance with a discreet knock. One by one, they filtered into the meeting place until all 13 remaining members of the gang were there.
You got it? You got the money?
As he had already planned, Grimshaw kept $1,200 for himself, since he was the ramrod of this bunch, and would give $200 apiece to the rest of the men. Grimshaw took the roll of bills from inside his shirt. He had already discreetly peeled off his share and stashed it in one of his pockets. He tossed the money on the table.
What do you think? There it is, boys. $2,800, as promised.
Wait a minute. There's only 13 of us here, not counting you, Jack. What about Nichols?
Nichols won't be collecting his share. The terror got him. Frank Morgan brought his body in from the woods.
Morgan? I heard he was in these parts. How do you know Morgan didn't kill Nichols?
Because he wasn't shot. His back was clawed so wide open that most of his blood spilled out.
Son of a bitch.
Radburn turned his head to look at Hooley. So did several of the other men.
What? You think I should have stayed there and got ripped open too?
What's done is done. What it amounts to is that there's an extra $200 in that roll. You fellas can split it up any way you want to.
I don't really care, as long as Hooley don't get any of the extra.
Yeah, that sounds good to me, too.
Take it! I don't want any of the damn money except my share.
Fine.
Radburn scooped up the roll from the table and began passing out the bills. One of the men was pretty good at ciphering, so he figured out that if they split the extra money evenly, everybody would get an extra $16.66.
How the hell are we gonna do that? These are $20 bills.
Grimshaw took a couple of double eagles from his pocket and slapped the gold pieces down on the table.
There you go, boys. That'll make it come out even. An extra 20 apiece.
We're obliged, Jack. You didn't have to do that.
We're all in this together, ain't we?
Most of us are, anyway.
You were playing peacemaker earlier, so don't go stirring up trouble now. The boss said he'd have more work for us in a while. Until then, just lie low. You can have a good time, but stay out of trouble. And whatever you do, watch what you say. No talking about anything that happened today.
I don't reckon any of us would much want to talk about that anyway, Jack.
After leaving the undertaking parlor with Marshall Price, Frank said goodbye to the lawman and led Goldie toward the livery stable, with Wolf padding along behind them. Patterson greeted the three of them with a friendly grin and set aside a wagon wheel hub he was greasing.
Heard you found another fella in the woods who'd been unlucky enough to run into the Terror.
Yeah, that's right. His body's down at the undertaker's. I'd be obliged if you'd go down there and take a look at it if you get a chance.
Me? Why me?
Because you have the best livery stable in town, from what I've seen. And probably a lot of strangers come here first when they get to Eureka. I'd like to know if you've seen this fella around. And more importantly, if you've seen him with anybody else.
Well, I reckon that makes sense. Sure, I'll mosey down there after a while and have a look. Can't say I'm real eager to take a gander at a corpse, though.
I don't blame you for that.
Frank led Goldie into the stall where the horse had spent the night and started unsaddling him. When he was finished with that chore, he walked back to the front of the barn. He had his bedroll in his hands.
I'm hoping you can tell me who the best doctor in town is, if there's more than one.
You sick or hurt?
No, I just need to ask him a couple of questions.
We got three doctors here in Eureka that I know of, but I'd say Dr. Connolly is the best one.
Patterson told Frank how to find the physician's office, which was on a side street at the other end of town.
Thanks.
Why don't you just leave the dog here? I was about to step out back and eat some lunch, and he seems mighty fond of my table scraps.
Sure. Wolf, stay. I'll see you later.
Carrying the bedroll, he headed along the street toward Dr. Connolly's office. As he did, Frank thought about Jack Grimshaw and wondered what his old comrade-in-arms was doing in this part of the world. A disturbing possibility occurred to him. If Emmett Bosworth had indeed hired a gang of killers to go after Chamberlain's men, then Grimshaw could be one of them. Even though they had been friends, Frank was honest enough with himself to realize that Grimshaw had always been more willing than he was to sign on for a job strictly for the money. Over the years, Frank had heard rumors that Grimshaw was mixed up in some pretty shady deals. But a little freelance outlawry was different from bushwhacking innocent men and then chopping them up with axes, Frank told himself. He didn't want to believe that Jack Grimshaw was capable of such a thing. And until he saw proof of it with his own eyes, he wasn't going to believe it. Dr. Patrick Connolly's practice consisted of a neat little cottage containing his surgery and examination rooms, backed up by a larger house that was obviously the doctor's home. No one answered Frank's knock on the office door, so he walked around back to the doctor's living quarters. The door there was opened by an attractive woman in her 30s with auburn hair and green eyes. She wore a wedding band on her left ring finger, so Frank figured she was Connolly's wife.
The doctor's having his dinner. He's not seeing any patients right now. You can wait on the front porch of the office if you like.
I'm not a patient, and I hate to disturb a man's dinner, but I need to ask him a question. Shouldn't take but a minute, and then I'll let him get back to his meal.
Who is it, Molly?
Just an old cowboy. Nothing for you to concern yourself with, Patrick.
Someone walked up and opened the door wider. The man who stood there was burly, built more like a prize fighter than a physician. He had a shock of gray hair and a salt and pepper beard.
I heard you say you have a question for me, sir. I hope for both of our sakes that it's a good one. Otherwise, we're both risking the wrath of my wife here.
I think it's a good one. It's about a bone.
Come in.
It's a poor doctor who doesn't take care of himself first.
My wife thinks my practice causes me to miss too many meals. You couldn't tell it to look at me, though, could you? Now, what's this about a bone?
I need to unwrap it.
By all means.
Frank set the bedroll on a divan and unrolled it. When he lifted the bone and held it up where the doctor could see it, Connolly's eyes widened.
You were right, my friend. That's definitely a bone.
Human, isn't it?
Yes. That's the radius, one of two bones that form the skeletal structure of a man's forearm. Or a woman's, although judging by the length and diameter of that one, I'd say it came from a man. Let me show you.
Connolly turned toward a bookcase that sat against one wall. He took a thick, leather-bound volume from one of the shelves and began flipping through it.
Gray's Anatomy?
You're familiar with it? You've had medical training?
Only enough practical experience to patch up a bullet wound or a knife slash or set a broken bone. But I do a considerable amount of reading when I get the chance in all subjects.
Yes, I'd venture a guess that you've encountered more wounds of violence than an average man. You see, here's a man's arm. The upper bone, between the shoulder and the elbow, is the humerus. The two lower bones, between the elbow and the wrist, are the radius and the ulna. What you have there is a radius, as I said. Where did you get it?
Before Frank could answer, Molly Connolly appeared in the doorway.
It would only take a minute, you said. Patrick, your food is getting cold.
I'm sorry, my dear. Our visitor... By the way, what is your name, sir?
Morgan. Frank Morgan.
Mr. Morgan has brought me a very intriguing artifact.
That? That's just an old bone.
Indeed, and Mr. Morgan was about to tell me where he got it.
Molly shook her head and left the room again.
Reckon I caused some trouble in your household.
Don't let it worry you. Molly is quick to anger, but even quicker to forgive. And she's an excellent nurse, not to mention easy on the eyes. May I?
Frank gave him the bone. Connolly brought it close to his face and studied it intently.
I found it in a cabin out in the woods.
It was by itself? No other remains?
Nope, just the one bone. And it was stuck almost out of sight, where it'd be easy to overlook.
Then someone took the rest of the skeleton and left this bone by accident.
That's what I'm wondering about.
One thing we can be certain of, the other bones didn't get up and walk away by themselves. What is it you want from me, Mr. Morgan? A simple confirmation that this bone came from a human skeleton? The answer is yes.
It doesn't look like it's been damaged.
Gnawed on, you mean. I agree. I don't see any teeth marks. I'd say it was picked clean by insects, not cannibals. That thought did enter your mind, didn't it, Mr. Morgan?
Maybe.
Wait a minute. Morgan, you're the man Rutherford Chamberlain hired to go after the Terror, the gunfighter. You're the talk of the town, along with the Terror itself, of course. Does this have something to do with the Terror?
I don't know yet. I'd like to ask you, though, as a man of science, do you believe all the stories that have been told about the Terror?
There have been reports of strange, unknown animals from around the world for years, Mr. Morgan, perhaps even for centuries. Did you know that in Africa there are creatures called gorillas, who are supposed to be half man, half ape? I'd love to see one someday.
What about the Terror? Could it really be some sort of monster instead of, say, a man?
I've seen some of the damage done by the Terror, Mr. Morgan.
So have I.
Do you think a man did that?
Doc! Doc! Come quick! Here's trouble!
Now what's all this disturbance? Oh, at this rate, you'll never finish your dinner, Patrick.
Occupational hazard, my dear. Occupational hazard. What's all this excitement about, Bert?
You gotta come downtown, Doc. A couple of Chamberlain's loggers just brought in a wagon, and it's plumb full of men who are all tore up.
Settle down, Bert. These men are all dead?
Yeah, they're all tore up.
Yes, you said that. It seems that they'd be more in need of the Undertaker's attention than mine.
All I know, Doc, is that Marshall Price told me to fetch you.
Very well. Do you mind if I hang on to this for the time being, Mr. Morgan? I might be able to determine a little more about it if I have time to study it.
That's fine, Doctor. Just keep it somewhere safe.
Connolly laid the bone on a small table where he'd placed the copy of Grey's Anatomy. He reached for his coat and hat, which hung on hooks next to the door, and put them on.
I'll be back as soon as I can, Molly. I doubt if there's any reason to keep my dinner warm, though. I expect I'll be downtown for a while.
Frank followed Connolly out of the house. Bert, the townie who had brought the news, was too excited to move at a normal pace. He broke into a run, obviously anxious to return to the main street.
Man's morbid curiosity. I see it all the time. There's nothing more intriguing than death. Probably because of its universality and inevitability.
Yeah, I expect there'll be quite a crowd gathered around that wagon.
Frank's prediction proved to be accurate. So many people were in the street that it was difficult to see the wagon itself. He spotted the man sitting on the seat holding the reins, though, and recognized Carl Wilcox, the logger he had met the day before. Wilcox looked pale and shaken, which wasn't surprising considering his cargo. Marshal Gene Price was on hand, too. When he saw Frank and Dr. Connolly approaching, he turned to the crowd.
All right, everybody get back. Get back there. Let the doctor through.
It's too late for sawbones, Marshal. Way too late.
You take a look, Doc, see what you think.
I think this gentleman is right. The time when my services might have come in handy has long since passed.
You've seen some of the other bodies that have been brought into town from the woods. These killings are work of the same creature.
I couldn't tell you that, Marshal, without a closer examination of the bodies. What I can say is that you should get them off the street. There's no need for this grotesque display. Take them down to the undertaking parlor, and I'll have a better look at them there.
All right, you heard the doc. Let's have some room here, damn it!
Reluctantly, the crowd moved back far enough so that Wilcox could flap the reins and get the team of mules moving again. Connolly followed the vehicle toward the undertaking parlor. Price hung back and frowned at Frank.
I saw you come up with the doctor, Morgan. You sick or something?
No, but I was discussing some medical matters with him.
If you're gonna hunt down that creature, Morgan, I hope to hell you do it soon.
Even though these killings aren't happening in my jurisdiction, I don't like seeing all these bodies brought into my town.
I'll be riding out again, right after I get something to eat.
You got an appetite after seeing that?
Oh, a man's gotta keep his strength up if he's gonna be hunting monsters.